I'm Steve Potter, and this is Cityscape. Coming up, a conversation with St. Louisan and former NEA chairman Rocco Landisman. And Gitana Productions explores the challenges of mixed identity. The St. Louis Art Museum's new East Building expansion opens tomorrow morning with a ribbon-cutting ceremony at 9:30. The entire museum was closed for the past 2 weeks to prepare for the grand opening. We had the opportunity to tour the new space earlier this month. We began outside in front of the East Building. Our tour guide was Museum Director Brent Benjamin.
When you think about the main building, one of the first things that comes to mind is stone, because it's a great big building made of limestone. And Chipperfield, David Chipperfield, the architect, felt that because the main building was masonry, the new building had to be masonry as well. But instead of being a sort of the turn of the 19th century masonry stone, he thought, well, you know, our masonry is concrete, so let's think about that as a material and let's use it in an aesthetic way. So the concrete, as you can see, is made up of a very, very dark gray cement. And then included in that cement are three different kinds of aggregates, all of which are Missouri River stone, including a limestone that actually is the same material that the main building is made from. So there's that direct relationship. There's also, that stone is about a sense of place and about this is a building that's here in the center of Forest Park, in the center of St. Louis, on the eastern edge of Missouri, and the materials reflect that to a great extent.
So the East Building is something like 200,000 square feet, the addition?
So the galleries and public spaces are 82,000 square feet. The parking garage is 215,000 square feet, so nearly 300,000 square feet in total.
As far as exhibition space, though, I think it increases what you have by 30%?
Roughly 30%, exactly. There are 21 galleries in the new building installed with some 230 works of art. 25% of those have not been on public view in over 20 years. Uh-huh. In the main building, 50 of the main building's 88 galleries have been reinstalled with about 1,500 works of art. And in that building, nearly a third of those works have not been on view in 20 years or more.
Well, it looks beautiful from the outside. Would you be kind enough to show me around?
Absolutely. Let's go.
Well, we've come through some beautiful large glass doors, so this is the main entrance. So where are we standing now?
We're standing in Taylor Hall, which is the lobby of the New East Building. Two key driving forces of this were, one, incremental gallery spaces for the collection. And as we have been talking about, we've got a huge percentage more art on view for the public than was the case previously. And that was really the driving force behind this. But secondly, we've inhabited for more than a century a World's Fair building that was never conceived of as a modern art museum. And so the amenities that we all expect, bathrooms, coat checks, information desks, are poorly located, in short supply, both in terms of volume, in terms of number and in terms of volume, and hard to get to.
You mentioned amenities, and the restaurant to our left there, which has a great view overlooking Art Hill, I guess.
It does. Yeah, we were very excited. The building is just high enough that you actually see out. You remember the old restaurant, looked at the back of the main building. Mm-hmm. This restaurant, we knew we had this wonderful site, and we thought, gosh, why not take advantage of the opportunity to have diners, you know, sit and have lunch and have a sense of the street life going on, of people walking by, of cars, of the park, of the Art Hill, and of the basin beneath.
And as we stand here, my eyes immediately go upwards. Wonderful skylights. What's the significance of those?
Yeah, it's the key architectural feature inside the building is actually the ceiling, which, you know, is a little bit of a poser in a way, but Chipperfield said to us very early on, you know, you're going to install primarily contemporary art in these spaces. The walls are going to be white, the floors are going to be wood or concrete, they're wood in the end. It's going to look like any generic space anywhere in the world for the display of contemporary art. How are we going to give this a character that is unique to the St. Louis Art Museum? So we're looking at the ceiling, and it is a 5-foot by 10-foot concrete grid. It's 4 feet deep. Was poured in place over the course of an entire summer in a series of pours. And what that does is not only continue that sense of monumentality that's present on the outside of the building to the inside, but it also provides a way to bring light in from outside. And so all the public spaces and all the permanent collection galleries are lit or can be lit with natural daylight.
Well, we've just come through the entrance. We're in Taylor Hall now. A lot of people will be seeing this building for the first time when they walk through the doors right behind us. So where should we go from here?
Well, one has options.
Why don't you show us someplace that you're fond of?
Let's do that.
Okay, we've come to the end of Taylor Hall.
So we were talking Steve about the fact that the collection is the driving force behind this expansion. And because of that, we decided early on that instead of offering a borrowed temporary exhibition for the opening, we would actually install the museum's collection in its entirety, or as far as space allows. So in the exhibition galleries, we've installed the museum's collection of post-war German art. It's something we're known for internationally. We have extraordinary holdings, and this really picks up with the art of Joseph Beuys following World War II, his principal students here in the first room, and then carrying on through those students and some of their work, which are some of the great holdings of the museum.
And the scale of some of these works, paintings, quite large.
That's right. So we're in the largest gallery of the temporary exhibition suite here, and you have the three great diptychs by Gerhard Richter. You have the great Kiefer over here, the mirror works by Richter here, and then two important works by Polka. These are, of course, monumental in scale, gigantic pictures. And the scale of the things in the museum's collection really drove the proportions of the galleries. In fact, when Chipperfieldus gave us his first proposal for the gallery layouts, we scratched our heads and said, you know, we better check the collection and make sure there's room for all the big things, because it's one of the characters of our post-war holdings that things tend to be very large. Earlier in the collection, things tend to be very domestic in scale, but not at this moment. And of course, it's one of the key characteristics of art of our time is scale. We'll see some of that in the American collections as well, where there's also some works of very significant scale.
Shall we walk that way?
Let's do that. Before we do this, though, let's take a look out this window. This building is organized in plan like a pinwheel with four arms that point north, south, east, and west. And at the end of each of those arms, the architect has developed developed them as a pavilion. So you look at it from the outside and you see actually a fairly modest scale with gigantic windows that are floor to ceiling. And we're standing now in what we've been calling breakout spaces, which are spots that you could step out of the galleries, have a seat, look at a catalog, take in the view of the park, look at the sculpture that's installed out here, a beautiful work by George Rickey that's been on loan to Chesterfield for many years and now is permanently installed here in phase one of the museum sculpture garden. Take a break, have a rest, chat with your date, you know, whatever you wanted to do. But the idea of a break in the museum experience, and also a reminder that we are still here in the middle of this beautiful park.
It makes you realize the importance of space, not just space that's filled with art, but just space for space's sake,
That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So now it's off to the collection galleries?
Let's do that. We'll go this way.
Of course, I'm a little turned around right now.
Right. Well, we're walking actually north. If we kept walking, we'd get our feet wet in Grand Basin. So we're taking our way through the exhibition gallery sequence. This is not only the museum's holdings of German painting and sculpture, but we received from Betsy Millard and her late husband, Earl, a wonderful collection of German drawings that complemented the museum's holdings of paintings. So this gallery really focuses on that recent gift. And then in this final gallery, a wonderful selection of photographs from the museum's collection.
You know, I'm wondering, walking around and seeing people put the final touches on things, have you had to increase your staff?
We have had to increase our staff. We have planned that all along. In fact, the campaign that supported the construction of this building was not only for bricks and mortar, but it was also for incremental operating endowment. And so we raised over $30 million for the museum's endowment, and that will largely support staff. We're hiring 25 incremental staff, primarily in the area of gallery, security, visitor services, environmental, to support the building and the public's experience of it.
Right. Well, you bring it up, so it's having a positive economic impact, obviously, on the economy here, and not just the addition of the staff, but the construction costs and the jobs that were provided over. How long has this project been going on?
Well, we broke ground in January of 2010. So, yes, it was the equivalent of 200 full-time people working on this building for 2.5 years. In the construction trades, across the trades, and then, of course, 25 new positions that are permanent here in the city.
And wasn't the capital campaign for this the largest ever in the city's history for this type of thing?
That's right, yeah. We finished at just over $160 million.
My tour guide of the St. Louis Art Museum's new East Building expansion is its director, Brent Benjamin. The expansion contains 21 new galleries, increasing the museum's gallery and public space by about 30%. There's a ribbon-cutting ceremony tomorrow morning at 9:30. For a visual sneak peek of the new expansion, visit stlpublicradio.org. We have a photo slideshow and video, which gives the museum a sense of place in Forest Park. Now back to our audio tour. We began outside, at the entrance to the East Building. We entered Taylor Hall, and then proceeded south, down a long, brightly lit corridor. That led us to the galleries which hold the museum's extensive collection of post-war German art. We then went to the furthest east point of the building. It has the kind of floor-to-ceiling windows that can be found throughout the new expansion. We turned around and headed back toward where we entered. We crossed Taylor Hall. That's where we passed through a gallery containing ancient sculptures and artifacts. And just beyond that is where the new East Building expansion connects to the main building. We pass through large glass doors, which are designed to control the climate between the two areas, and that's where director Brent Benjamin continued our tour.
So we start the installation in the collection galleries with Surrealism in New York, which is Americans' response to movements in Europe, primarily during the war, and then head right into, you know, some of the greatest paintings ever made, which is abstract expressionism of the 1950s and early 1960s. In New York, the moment when the center of the art world moves from Paris, where it had been for the first half of the 20th century.
This is an interesting piece. I'd really enjoy hearing you describe this to a radio audience.
So John Chamberlain. So, you know, this is painting. This is one of the views about art of the 50s and 60s is action painting, and this is action sculpture. So this is John Chamberlain, and this is car parts that have been compressed.
I was going to say it looked like a wrecked Cadillac or something.
Absolutely. But this is actually expressive and gestural, very much like the painting by Franz Klein that's on the wall behind it. And that is really the impact, is how do I make a work of sculpture that's abstract, it has no relationship to perceived reality, and that is expressive. I think probably also want to look into this. Often this movement is read as a response to the horrors of World War II. And so you can see that in this quite appropriately as well.
Well, I think we'll take an image of this and post that on our website. Our listeners might like to see that. You have to see it. It's hard to describe.
Yeah, well, I think it's great. I mean, it's one of the reasons to come to the museum is to see these things on view.
Right.
So we move from abstract expressionism into really the second generation, and you can see that these artists here, which include Helen Frankenthaler, Robert Motherwell, and so on, really responded to the first generation painters in the same way. You see these great big gestures of paint. You see large canvases in terms of scale, and you don't see any kind of reality that you can identify. These are, you know, pure abstraction, non-objective painting. They don't relate to perceived reality directly at all.
And you call this the New York School.
That's right.
What's around the bend?
Well, around the bend is minimalism. And as you can see, a very geometric approach to art making, very restrained in terms of colors, in terms of shapes. And in fact, artists here, Larry Bell in the center, or Dan Flavin in the corner, actually working, you know, almost not with objects at all, but with light. So really taking the art object out of the realm of the physical and into the perceptual.
And another beautiful window to the exterior. And it hadn't occurred to me either until I was here that I was thinking of other museums I've been in. I'm usually not aware of seeing the outside space like you can here.
That's right. And it was a goal of the Oversight Committee, and it was one that Chipperfield embraced, was this notion of taking advantage of these beautiful views. And here we have a view of the south portico of the main building. And I think that something that this demonstrates is that, you know, when you think about the Beaux-Arts and neoclassical architecture, you think about, you know, all the frosting on the wedding cake, you know, all the doodads and the column capitals and the entablatures and the dentils and all that kind of decoration. But in fact, the classical orders are really about order. That's why they're called orders, and they have very specific kinds of geometric relationships in those buildings, and Cass Gilbert was a master at that. Chipperfield is as well, and here we don't have all the frosting pipe and the wedding cake, but we have the cake itself, and this rigorous order that Chipperfield has used to develop the East Building is one of the clearest relationships there is with the more decorated order of the original building.
Gorgeous view, and the cloudscape looks like it was meant to be.
Yes, it's beautiful today, isn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. Well, you mentioned the Dan Flavin work that uses light. May we see that?
Sure.
Let's walk over there.
So this is a work by Dan Flavin, recent acquisition by the museum. an artist who in the 1960s began to use fluorescent tubes to create his works of art. And it's not so much the tubes themselves that are the art, but it's the light that's created by the tube. As you can see here, you have blue, red, and yellow light, and it's really about really intended to evoke color and space. Is what this is about. So light is actually the medium here. It's not paint, it's not a bronze sculpture, it's not a wood carving, it's actually light as the medium of art.
And of course, what we're seeing is the blue fluorescent light.
That's right.
And you don't realize at first there's another color behind that's bouncing off the walls. It's very subtle.
That's right. There's actually two. There's the reddish pink on that color, and there's actually yellow over here.
Well, we're visiting with Brent Benjamin of the St. Louis Art Museum, and we're taking a tour of the new East Building, which is getting ready to open to the public.
And here we are in a gallery devoted to pop art, which is a movement of the 1960s that is inspired by popular culture, as the name pop art implies. So you see the Bende dots that are derived from commercial printing and advertising here by Roy Lichtenstein, made into a work of high art. You see a recent gift of a work by George Siegel, a plaster cast of a real individual, in this case Richard Bellamy, who was his dealer.
Now, I've noticed a couple of things, if I can jump in.
You sure can.
I noticed a roll of toilet paper, and it looks like a Playboy bunny.
You do, a roll of toilet paper and a Playboy bunny. So this is by Jim Dine, and it is a painting about a bathroom wall, and there's a medicine chest and a roll of toilet paper and an electric light that's actually on, but there are also electric light beams. There are also light beams painted on the painting.
Oh,
and then
yes,
there's a toothbrush holder. So, you know, it's everyone's experience of brushing his teeth before he goes to bed at night or something like that. And then in the corner is the work that people either love or they hate it, and it's a work by Dwayne Hansen, very famous for these incredibly naturalistic portrayals of people, everything from security guards to policemen to tourists, and in this case, it's a Playboy bunny. And there she is, you know, with her little costume, and she's got a drink on the table that she's about ready to serve. And this is, of course, again, a derivation from popular culture, in this case, the Playboy clubs of the 1960s.
So where are we now?
Well, we're just heading into a gallery that has been developed by the curators around a number of works of sculpture and works of assemblage, or works of assembly, that are in the museum's collection, each of which relates in an interesting way either to the natural or the urban environments. So we have Richard Long's Mississippi Circle here on the floor, commissioned work.
At first I thought the construction wasn't done.
Yeah, no, that's right. But these are, you know, Mississippi Circle stones that came from the Mississippi River that he made into a work of land art in a way, although, of course, it's inside.
Uh-huh.
We have a feather wheel. That's a kinetic work by Ronnie Horn over here on the wall. There's a whirlpool that actually functions. It's not on now because we would be damaging the recording capacity of your machines if we did. But that'll be running. And then at the end, this
what's that? That's beautiful.
Work that covers the entire wall by a quite important living African-American artist named Leonardo Drew, who was the subject of a Currents exhibition a number of years ago, and this work was acquired. It's the first time we've ever been able to install it at its full height. I mean, as you can see, it fills the entire 16-foot height of the gallery. It's not actually even installed at its full width. It's still missing one row of panels on the end, but it looks just stunning in this space.
Okay, you've helped me so far figure out where I am and what direction I'm going. We see another window in this gallery, and it's a parking lot, although I'm not sure what direction I'm looking.
Well, you see out over the back of the museum site and down the hill and then across the road, and then down below you see some reflections, and those are indeed the windshields of cars in the zoo's parking lot. Ultimately, this space gets developed as the sculpture garden we were talking about before, and so there'll be 400 or 500 trees planted and sculptures from the museum's collections placed outside to the south of the building. So this is a temporary view.
And, you know, you talked about how a lot of what we're going to be seeing are things that the museum has had in the collection that hasn't been viewed in years and years. I'm sure there are some new acquisitions as well.
There are new acquisitions not only in the East Building but also in the main building, quite a few, in fact. And, in fact, we're just passing one here on the wall. This is a work by a local artist. I should say he was born here and grew up here, went to school here. He lives in New York now. His name is Tom Friedman. This is an acquisition the museum made in 2012 at the end of the year, so we've only actually had it for 6 months. So the first time on view, as you can see, it's a seascape. Tom works in a very conceptual kind of a mode, and so although it looks as though it's a painting or a drawing, it's actually a work of folded and creased paper.
Are there any other new acquisitions that you'd like to share with us?
You know, Steve, there's something in almost every gallery, but I want to share one in particular with you, which is a major commission by the museum from the British sculptor Andy Goldsworthy, which is a site-specific work installed in a courtyard on the lower level.
Let's go.
So one can come in the parking garage and go right up to Taylor Hall. Or if you were going to the auditorium for a lecture or for performance or for the Saturday afternoon opera from the Met, you could take a left and come up this concourse that connects not only to the South Building, but also right into Sculpture Hall.
This is a lengthy hall.
This is a lengthy hall. So we thought, how do we make a lengthy hall more interesting? So on the left, you see a number of architectural elements, most of which are by Louis Sullivan, most of which come from St. Louis buildings, but also from his two principal students, Frank Lloyd Wright and Elmsley. Here we are with the first access point into the museum. This takes you into the museum's Ancient American Galleries and Oceanic Galleries. And then just up here around the corner, you get a glimpse of this massive commission from British sculptor Andy Goldsworthy.
It's an interesting view of a work seen through windows, so you don't see the complete work at one time. You sort of have to work at it.
It's one of the magical things about this is that it's conceived to be seen not only from beneath, as we stand slightly beneath it here in the concourse, but from above, out on the terrace behind the museum. And also it's conceived to be walked in so that one can go out and walk among the arches. Now that's going to be on a limited basis because there's an occupancy limit out there. But this is a work entitled Stone Sea, and it's a meditation on the fact that here in the heartland we are at the base of an ancient ocean. And the limestone that we see everywhere around St. Louis and along the river is the remnant geological remnant of that time created by the sand that was at the base of the ocean. So this stone was quarried just south of St. Louis in Perryville, Missouri, and conceived by Andy in a form he uses a lot, this arched form, to really provide the idea of motion and movement. And if you see it from outside, you get the sense of splashing, moving water.
Very nice.
So Andy developed this over the last year and a half and then was here in the fall of 2012 to install it with a crew of his workmen. And it was great fun to watch them put these things in such close proximity to the building and to each other.
And you talk about the light effect. I can just imagine through the day, this would look different every 20 minutes, I would think.
And we had a chance to see it in the snow during the winter, and
oh,
it was spectacular.
Yeah. Well, it looks great through the window. Could I get a closer look?
Absolutely. So we're going out in the courtyard, and you get a sense here for just how densely he's installed these arches, which are extraordinary. These are, you know, real Roman arches, no mortar, no pins.
Oh, really?
Held together with a keystone in the classic tradition. As you can see, that at either end of the courtyard, they die into the walls. So this idea that they continue on throughout and under the building, and this notion of this sort of fluidity that was all over this region in ancient history.
And on one side of the courtyard, we have the East Building. On the other side, the original.
That's right. So it really provides a nice link between the old and the new.
We've been talking with Brent Benjamin, the director of the St. Louis Art Museum, and what a tour this has been for us. We started outside with a look at the new addition, the new building. We've walked through the new building. Now we're back into a center courtyard between the new building and the old building. It's been quite a trip.
That's right. Well, I'm really pleased to have had the chance to show it to you.
You're opening to the public on Saturday. You've got 2 days of special events. So what would you tell people about what to expect and what they need to know before they come?
Well, we really invite every member of the St. Louis community to join us for this special occasion. We're going to cut the ribbon at 9:30 on Saturday morning, June 29th, and at 10 o'clock the doors will open. We'll be open from 10 to 10 on Saturday and 10 to 5 on Sunday. And from 10 to 5 both days, there is a public celebration, a world of art that is going to be held in the East parking lot in front of the museum, and that has a number of booths that are hosted by some of our wonderful institutional and community colleagues, with arts making hands-on activities, and I think there's some food and some performances as well.
Well, I'm so appreciative that you shared this and gave us a sneak peek ahead of time. Thank you so much for your hospitality.
It's my pleasure.
Coming up next on Cityscape, a conversation with Rocco Landisman. This is St. Louis Public Radio.